So this morning we had part one of this class, and for those of you who weren't here, and actually for those of you who were too, we'll just have a quick review of what we went through. So in the introduction, we talked about the importance of a basis for the marriage relationship. So we're talking about dating. When we talk about godly relationships, I mean romantic relationships before marriage. We're talking about dating, and the importance of dating is that we're talking about the foundation of marriage. And marriage is the most important human relationship we experience. You know, outside our relationship with God, we have no more important relationship than that with our spouse, the marriage relationship. And God even uses that relationship to model or to parallel the relationship between Christ and the saints. And so it really underscores its importance. A lot of times we don't really get a whole lot of advice on dating. There's two things which are certainly true. Make sure you marry someone in the truth and don't have sexual interactions until you're married. Of course, those things are very true. We can't diminish from either one of those. But, sometimes it leaves you wishing for a little more guidance than that. How do I deal with a person I'm attracted to on a day-to-day level? In our interactions on a day-to-day level. So that's what we're talking about here. The next thing we talked about was what is love? We know love is used in a lot of different ways. She loves shopping. He loves orange soda. They're in love. We talk about loving our families, loving our brothers and sisters in Christ. And we looked at a few verses in the scripture that specifically talk about the love between a man and a woman, husband and a wife. And we found that same type of love is used when we're told to love our neighbors, our enemies, to love God, masters. The love of money is spoken of as the same way. And so we find that contrary to the ideas of the world that we can put romantic love in a basket over here and it plays by its own rules that are completely different than any other relationships that we have or interactions with other people. On the contrary, the Bible does not separate them that way. It doesn't say that love plays by different rules. Romantic love plays by different rules than the rest of our relationships. We went over a couple of stories. One was Peter and Jesus in the garden. Remember that Jesus was willing to submit to death when he was arrested, but Peter was not willing to allow that to happen. He took out a sword and cut off the servant of the high priest's ear. They had dramatically different responses to the situation, and we found why that was. It was because Jesus knew what would happen to him. He knew all things that would happen to him, it says. But it says the other disciples were ignorant of these things. They understood not these things. So Jesus was acting out of love according to knowledge. Peter was acting out of love according to ignorance. And we find the same thing a lot of times in couples today. The other story that we talked about was of one couple that meets very quickly, gets interested in each other and falls in love and makes what the world likes to call love to one another after their first date and start a string of betrayal, anger, divorce, skepticism towards love, and ultimately bitterness. And another couple that takes things very responsibly talks about the positions and limitations of dating, how they should approach one another, and though that's not always fun at the time, in the end it works out quite well for them. And they actually go to the extreme to flee fornication. They go to the extreme, what a lot of people would call an extreme, of sharing their first kiss on their wedding day. And so you have these two complete opposite pictures. Both of them, though, say they did what they did out of love. And it's the same contrast that we find there in the garden. One is acting out of love in ignorance. They don't know what's best for themselves. They don't know what's best for their partner. They don't know how to responsibly interact with one another. The other couple does. Okay, so you have, the difference is in knowledge. Are you going to love someone in complete ignorance, trying to follow your own ways? You're going to love someone according to knowledge, according to God's knowledge, so that you have a blessing on it. And then the last thing we talked about was when God created marriage. We went back to Genesis, talked about God looking on man and understanding his need. It says, God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make an help meet for him." Okay, he understood that man had a need. You can talk about it as a hole inside of man. He was not complete yet. And God knew exactly what fit that hole. Does anybody remember? what we talked about that was? What's that? I heard someone say something. Marriage, exactly. Yeah, marriage. It was a commitment that he needed. He didn't need a one-night stand. He didn't need a hookup. He didn't need a lot of hookups. What he needed was commitment. He needed to be completely committed to someone and have that person be completely committed to him. Okay, that's what fills man's hole. That's what fills the void, the need. And of course, we compare that to a child who is very hungry, the point of starvation. Their digestive system is shutting down and they have this terrible pain in their stomach. And at that situation, in their desperation, they may think that anything that they can put down their throat will help the situation. And then we talked about them putting rat poison down their throat. They filled the void because they had such a craving, but they made the situation worse, didn't they? And that's what 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18 tells us. He that commits fornication sins against his own body. It's like you're trying to fill that void, that hole that you feel, that need for something, companionship, but you fill it with something that doesn't belong there. You fill it with fornication instead of commitment. And that's why it's a sin against your own body, because in the end, it's worse. After you've committed fornication, it's worse. You feel that hole more acutely than you did before. Okay? So that's where we left off. So I want to tell you another story. It's a story about intimacy without commitment, but it's quite an easy one, I think, for you to understand. And hopefully it will stick with you in a way that maybe the rest of these classes don't. So I was on the plane on my last trip. I went over to Kenya. Okay, so I'm on my last trip, and my flight attendant there on the second flight, she's this really charming young lady. She's got this beautiful complexion. She's got a beautiful voice, this really coy accent. And, you know, of course, she's from somewhere else. She finds my complexion quite attractive, too. It's very different than hers. So I tell her, I love your skin. And she returns the compliment. Now, while our skin was quite different, we both admired the other. So perhaps we could make a deal. Okay, perhaps I could give her some of my skin in return for some of hers. I asked her if she'd like to make a trade. Small portion of her beautiful complexion for a small portion of mine. I wasn't asking for all of her. Neither was she going to get all of me, only a part. In her fascination with my complexion, she agreed. Once we landed, we met up in the terminal. I got my checked luggage, found my pocket knife, pulled it out, and I carefully cut a small rectangle from the inside of my arm. Pulled the flesh off, handed her the knife, and she did the same. And then we traded. And I had a little piece of that complexion that I wanted so much. Do you know the rest of that story? Well, depending on how dense someone is, that delusion might last a few hours, or we might realize we both robbed one another in a matter of a few minutes. The flesh that we desired so much before now festers and rots and stinks. It turns from an object of lust into one of disgust. What we once longed for, we now cannot stand. Who wants a piece of dead, rotting flesh? And to add injury to insult, the wound from the trade is as painful as ever, despite how worthless the piece of flesh we gained was. The flesh I have of hers cannot fix the wound I now have. Nor can we reverse the trade. We can't trade back and fix that, can we? The skin, once removed, cannot be reattached. The action cannot be reversed. I took from her, she took from me, but neither of us gained anything. I craved something. I got it, but it did not satisfy, did it? And the same for her. I took from her, and she took from me, but neither of us gained anything. We both lost. We both left hurt, but neither of us left satisfied. And the wound, it does not heal near as fast as that flesh rots, does it? Perhaps one day after weeks and months of pain and festering and redness, the wound we happily gave ourselves will heal, but it will never disappear. It will always be a scar that reminds us of our foolishness, our stupidity and the price we paid for it. It will be a mark of shame that we try to hide, for who could explain such a foolish action? That is affection without commitment. The change that occurs when we trade a part of ourselves for a part of someone else. There's a story of this. The scriptures tell us of it. It tells us that the flesh we once desired will be abhorred when we obtain it in the wrong way. When we obtain it in a way inconsistent with God's commands. Turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 13. 2 Samuel chapter 13. And I'm going to get Brother Pat to read this for us. It's not quite the situation we just described, but the principles are the same. And it's a striking example of how we want something so badly, but when we take it the wrong way, it turns into something we detest because we did it wrong. So let's start at the beginning of the chapter in 2 Samuel 13.
And it came to pass after this that Absalom the son of David had a fair sister, whose name was Tamar. And Amnon the son of David loved her. And Amnon was so vexed that he fell sick for his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin. And Amnon thought it hard for him to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend, whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very subtle man, and he said unto him, "Why art thou, being the king's son, lean from day to day? Wilt thou not tell me?" And Amnon said unto him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." And Jonadab said unto him, "Lay thee down on thy bed, make thyself sick. When thy father cometh to see thee, say unto him, 'I pray thee, let my sister Tamar come, and give me meat and dress the meat in my sight, that I may see it, and eat it at her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and made himself sick. And when the king was come to see him, Amnon said unto the king, "I pray thee, let Tamar my sister come, and make me a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat at her hand." Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Go now to thy brother Amnon's house and dress him meat." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was laid down. And she took flour and kneaded it, and made cakes in his sight, and did bake the cakes. And she took a pan and poured them out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, "Have out all men from me." And they went out every man from him. And Amnon said unto Tamar, "Bring the meat into the chamber, that I may eat of thine hand." And Tamar took the cakes which she had made, and brought them into the chamber to Amnon her brother. And when she had brought them unto him to eat, he took hold of her and said unto her, "Come lie with me, my sister." And she answered him, "Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not do this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee." Howbeit, he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Amnon said unto her, "Arise, be gone." And she said unto him, "There is no cause. This evil in sending me away is greater than the other that thou didst unto me." But he would not hearken unto her. Then he called his servant that ministered unto him and said, "Put now this woman out from me and bolt the door after her." And she had a garment of divers colors upon her, for with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins appareled. Then his servant brought her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and rent her garment of divers colors that was on her and laid her hand on her head and went on crying. And Absalom, her brother, said unto her, Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? But hold now thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Regard not this thing. So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. 2 Samuel 13, 1 through 20.
Thank you, Brother Pat. Does this sound a bit like the story I just told you? Note the language that's used here. Whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for you, you shall be as one of the fools in Israel. You see, Tamar realized the results of this type of indulgence. She realized that trading a part of a person leaves a shameful wound. A wound that displays to all who see it the utter foolishness of the person who incurred it. She realized the folly of man's ways. Whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for you, you shall be as one of the fools in Israel. She knew that God understood what mankind needed, and that outside of that way we only poison ourselves. We only injure ourselves. She knew that the flesh that was traded would be worthless, and the wound incurred horrible. But Amnon would not accept the wisdom of her words. Note the wording here as well. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly. The hatred was more intense even than the desire he had towards her before. He had taken that piece of himself for that piece of herself and immediately realized he had been robbed in doing so. He had lost a piece of himself and gained a piece of corruption. When he got what he wanted, its beauty vanished. All the desire he had for it was gone, and in its place was disgust. He now abhorred what he had sacrificed part of himself for. He had robbed Tamar in order to rob himself. It was perfect foolishness, perfect shame, utter stupidity. You see, any type of temporary intimacy is double robbery. Any type of temporary intimacy is double robbery. It is poison in the empty belly. We're trying to fill a void with something that does not fill it, that does not belong there. It is a wound and a piece of rotting flesh that cannot cover the wound, that cannot be returned and that cannot be forgotten. When a human has the need, the overwhelming desire for intimacy. Do y'all know what I mean when I say intimacy? Do you know what I mean when I say intimacy? Romantic involvement, touching someone, feeling someone near you. That's intimacy. When someone has that overwhelming desire for intimacy, what he or she needs is commitment. And we feel it as a craving for sexual things, but what we need is commitment. The need of man is for someone to give all of himself to, and someone who will give all of herself to him. Not just for a short while. When I say all of himself or all of herself, I mean the whole body, the whole heart, the whole mind, for the whole life. Getting only part of any of those things ruins the relationship. Giving all of your body, all of your heart, and all of your mind to someone for part of your life doesn't cut it. It's still double robbery. It's the same story as two people trading a piece of their skin. Giving all of yourself for a short time is not giving all of yourself, is it? When God asks for all of ourselves in service to Him, does He mean give Him your whole body and heart and mind for a short while? No. Giving all of yourself means giving your whole life. Young men, remember this. When you see a beautiful woman with the most perfect body, the most perfect face, the most perfect smile, she's just intoxicating, and you want a little piece, remember that once you have that little piece, it will be hideous. It will be sickening. Young women, remember this. Once you make that trade, once you give a piece of yourself to a man before full commitment is made, you are putting the blade to a part of your body. And you are handing that part of your body to him. And in return, you are getting a bloody body part from him. But what about when it's done correctly, you ask? What about when two people are married? What about when that commitment is made? What's the difference there? Well, the difference is that when a full commitment is made, the body is given over intact. Consider the story differently. If I was so sure of the value of a young lady that I was willing to give everything for all of her, what if she was willing to do the same for me? To give everything for all of me. Do we need a knife to do that? No. I'm giving my body over wholly to her, intact. The beauty remains. It is preserved. And she's giving her whole body, her whole life to me. The beauty remains intact. It's maintained. The two objects of affection are preserved. That is a completely different picture, isn't it? That is God's way. Perfect, complete commitment of the whole person for life. That is what fills the void. That is what satisfies the craving. So I'm doing this talk in several modules for those of you that weren't here in the first class. So you'll see me switch out every now and then. These are each going over a slightly different topic, but that each applies. So Brother Lee, after the last class, he asked me a question that I'm sure many of us have considered. I thought of it several times. What if there's simply not someone in the truth for you? What if there isn't that wonderful partner we've been talking about that's willing to give their whole self to you, that respects class, that wants to have a godly relationship? What if that partner's just not there? Then what? It's something I've struggled with myself. And I ask myself, am I just being too picky? Am I just being ungrateful for the sisters that are there? And at one of those points, I wrote down this dialogue as a reminder of the real situation. So it's obviously fictional, okay? But it's a dialogue that tells a story or tells a point. And I wrote it for myself so that I would be reminded of these things. So it's something that you should read when you're upset because you don't have a partner, okay? God says to me, would you like to put in your order for a wife? I say, yeah, for sure. I can do that. When can I get her? God says, well, I'll let you lay out your relationship schedule too, actually. So whenever you like, you can get her. Oh, that's awesome. God says, all right, go ahead and tell me exactly what kind of woman you would like as your wife. Don't generalize. I need specific information to form each gene in her DNA structure. Describe her in detail and I'll take care of the rest. Describe to me the wife that you want to spend the rest of your life with in detail, and I'll take care of the rest. God says, go on. You know what you want, right? Do you understand what makes a woman attractive to you, apparently? What makes you tick? I'm going to say, God says, start with the top. On a scale of 1 to 100, give me the fineness of her hair. Fine as her hair. And give me the average length of her hairs. I want a list of hairstyles that she will use. Give me the tone of her hair, the darkness on a scale of 1 to 100. Amount of red and yellow hue present in her hair. Choose the rate of growth of her hair as well. I said, I don't know, Lord. I never really thought about it that exactly. I kind of favor long-haired brunettes, I guess. God says, that's a little too vague, Glennon. You wanted control. You wanted to take over control of your relationship life? Go ahead. I need the specifics, though. I'll make her just as you say. I say, I'm not sure I can get quite that specific. I'm not sure what I want. I just know what I've liked in the past. And of course, it's going to matter what the rest of her looks like too. I mean, some girls look good in dark hair, some in light. Some in shorter hair, some in long. It depends on a lot of things. I mean, her face, her height, her complexion, her proportions. God says, okay, then tell me about her facial features. I'll need to know facial proportions. Let's start with the eyes. Tell me what you want for the size of the eyes. Actually, I need to know the size of the pupil, size of the iris, the size of the whites, the curvature and the reflectivity of the eye lens, the vision strength at each distance, sensitivity to light and to each color, and size, flexibility, and wrinkling pattern of the eyelids, and the shades of each, of course. That'll give us a start. Then we can move on to the surrounding areas, such as the eyelashes, and how the eyes meet the other areas of the face. As we work on this, be thinking about the personality traits she should have, and exactly what past experiences she'll need to have developed those traits just so. The eyes are a big part of personality and communication, you know. At this point, I'm completely overwhelmed and very scared. And I think to myself, this is really it. I mean, what if I mess this up? I don't know a thing about this stuff, and I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life living with what I come up with. It's kind of like trying to make that decadent cheesecake we talked about in the last class when you've never used an oven. God says, well, I don't really know, God. I think you know what turns me on better than I do, actually. I mean, you made my brain. You made my personality. You understand my profile of attraction in a way that I never could. You understand how my character would be influenced by another person and how each of her traits will work with my own. Could you maybe just make her for me? You know exactly what I want and more importantly, what I need. God says, that's generally what I do, Glendon. I do things just like I know is best. But I thought you wanted something different than my version. I mean, you were unhappy waiting for my way of doing things. That's why I was letting you take charge of that. So why exactly are we having this conversation anyway if you don't have a clue what's going on? I say, I don't know, Lord. Go ahead. You know way better than me. I was out of my mind wanting to butt in. So God, He's really condescending here. He says, all right then, when exactly would you like to have her? I say, now that I do know. Good then. Let's start with your first meeting, and then you can lay out the whole schedule for your relationship from there, including your marriage. Can you give me the exact date and time you'd like to meet her and describe exactly where and how? Let me know the events for each of you that should lead up to that meeting, as, of course, each event preceding a meeting has a very significant impact on it and how you interact afterwards. I say, well, I'd like it to be real soon if we can do that. God says, of course I can do that. You think I'm limited by time and circumstance? When exactly? I'm a little less confident now. Well, on a good day for both of us, I guess. I mean, of course. Well, I think. God says, if you'll define a good day, I can give you a list of those in your future to choose from. What exactly is a good day in your estimation? I don't know, a good day for meeting someone you're going to marry. And exactly what does a day like that entail? Describe it, Glendon. You're in charge here, remember? That's what you wanted. I say, God, I don't really know. I says, well, we'll come back to that. Maybe you can at least give me a general overview of the relationship timeline for now. Simply give me on a 1 to 100 scale, if you will, the amount of platonic and romantic involvement from each of your perspectives at each month of the first year you know each other. I really don't know how to do that, Father. I'm sorry. Well, do you know when you two should be married? No, I'm sorry. God says, which of you should be the healthiest? Which of you the smartest? Which of you the godliest? Which of you should die first? God, I really don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know any of this. God says, you said you knew when you wanted to have your wife. You said you knew better than I did. Isn't that why you were unhappy? What do you say to that? You say, I'm sorry. I want it your way, God. I don't want it my way. I want you to decide what I need, and I want you to decide when I need it. I think God would say something like, I generally do, but you seem to have gotten the idea you could do a better job. He'd probably say something like, I'd hate to see you live with the results of taking control of things for yourself. So basically what it comes down to is that we are in a very limited sight position, aren't we? We can't see everything right now. We can't know everything right now. By the application of our minds, we can understand what is revealed by God, but no more. And that is where our trust is exercised. That's what was missing in that story, wasn't it? Trust. There are many times in our lives that we may ask God for something or want something, but we are made to understand that we cannot have it, at least not right now. If it's something that we really want, though, we often have a lot of questions as to why we cannot have it. Sometimes, as young kids, we ask for things we really shouldn't have at the time. Imagine a small boy of, say, 5 years old, asking his father for a hunting rifle. Father replies, "No, son, you can't have a rifle, and you can't use mine. Leave him alone." Now, at this point, the little boy knows the answer is no. If he trusts his father, that will be enough. Although, no doubt, he has many more questions. Like, why can't I have one? Because you don't know how to be safe with it. You're not old enough. Well, can I learn to be safe when you're older? Well, why do I have to be older? Because you don't have the responsibility that you need to develop. You're not coordinated enough to use one. You're not strong enough to use one. Well, how old do I have to be before I'm strong enough? Well, how old do I have to be before I'm responsible enough? I mean, the questions could go on and on and on, right? You ever answered all the questions a five-year-old has about something he really wants and can't have? At the end of the day, though, really, a five-year-old doesn't need all that information. All he really needs to know is the answer right now is no. The boy must simply trust that his father is right, although he does not fully understand the situation. He doesn't fully understand the reason for the answer or when the answer will change. He has 1,000 questions he might ask that he thinks will help him accept the answer, but he will not get all the answers to those questions, will he? His father will tell him what he needs to know, which is simply that right now, the answer is no. Sometimes there will be an explanation of why. Other times there will not. All that remains thereafter is for the little boy to trust him and go on. Now, just like this little boy, when we want something, when we really want something and God does not provide it, or he doesn't allow it by his direct commands or by the situation that we're in, it is common to ask him our 1,000 questions one at a time, and we demand an answer to each, as if we have the right to know, as if he must show us why or else he is wrong. This is not trust. It is distrust. It is challenging his goodness, his rightness, his judgment. This is not right, nor does it help us. All we really need to do is process his answer, accept it, and go on. A lot of times that's the hardest things in our lives to do. To process an answer, accept it, and go on. Just like this little boy, when we want something and God does not provide it or does not allow it by direct command or by the situation we're in, it's common to feel unsatisfied. Now, when the answer is no, sometimes it's a permanent no, means it will not change. Other times it is a no for now, but it may change later. For instance, if we really want to serve another God, God tells us no. And we know that that answer is permanent. Never are you allowed to serve another God. How about if we really want a spouse? We really want a spouse and God has laid out guidelines for us. We need a spouse in the truth. And we don't see a potential spouse in the truth. We know the answer is no right now because there are no acceptable spouses, but that may change with time. So then we want to ask, will I get one later? Then we want to ask, when will I get it? Then we want to ask, you know, the other 998 questions we have about it. These are questions we also will probably not have answered. You may or may not get a spouse later. God knows, but you and I don't necessarily need to. All you need to know at the moment is that the answer now is no. Now trust him and move on. That's not an easy thing for me to accept. That's really tough for me. So what do we do in the meantime, though? What do you do in the meantime? I want to get on with my romantic side of life. I want to find my spouse and start my dream of marrying the perfect man or the perfect woman, right? I don't feel that way. What do you do in the meantime? You keep pouring your energy into that? You got like 100% of my energy and 98% of it's poured into finding myself a spouse. And it's not one. I've looked everywhere I can. There's not one. Do I keep pouring 98% of myself into finding that spouse? That doesn't make very much sense, does it? There's something I realized a little while ago, probably a year or two ago. You know, when people say, I'm single, but I'm not looking. I was thinking about that. So, you know, say I'm at the doctor's office and I'm waiting in line and a gorgeous girl comes through the door. Do I have to be looking to notice her? Hey, young guys, ask me. Do you think I have to be looking to notice her? No. Of course I'm going to notice her. I'm sitting there, you know, I'm not paying any attention to trying to find my spouse. And this beautiful woman walks in and I'm just like, sorry. I mean, that's just a natural reaction, right? I don't have to be spending 98% of my energy trying to look for that spouse to notice that she's there, right? No way. No way. So it's like, what does that really mean that we're looking? Does it mean we're desperate for someone? Being open to the possibility of meeting your spouse is not the same as looking. When you're looking, you're putting way too much energy into it. Because when God has the right person in mind, you're going to see them. Without stressing yourself out about, did I miss her? Did I miss her? Did she walk by and I didn't notice? No, pretty girls don't walk by without you noticing. This doesn't happen. I think girls, that's probably the same for y'all. So what do we do in the meantime? If we don't have to spend all our time and energy checking out each person we meet, what do we spend that time and energy on? God. We've got lots of things to get excited about. It may not be as easy to get excited about as a pretty girl or a good-looking guy, but we've got lots of things to be excited about. Instead of trying to get excited about what God hasn't given you yet, get excited about what He has given you. He has given you the truth. He has given you brothers and sisters. He's given you gatherings, study weekends, weeknight classes. He's given you people all around you to share the truth with. How many of y'all interact with people every week that don't know the truth yet? Well, not very many. Okay, lots. Lots of y'all interact with people every week that don't know the truth yet. There's something to pour yourself into. Pour yourself into that. Again, I don't have this written down, but I do want to talk about it. When we're trying to share the truth with someone, and I've been really guilty of this myself, and I'm sure a lot of other people can identify with me. You know, so let's say say you're at school, you're in a class, I don't care if you're in high school or college or what, in this class, and I don't know, say there's 200 people in there. So it's a big class. 200 people in your class, and there's like five of them that are pretty. Okay? 200 people in the class. There's five. If you're a guy, there's five pretty girls in there. If you're a girl, there's like these five good-looking guys in there. Okay? You noticed them all the first day. I mean, it took like 5 minutes to pick them out, right? It's just natural. And you start thinking, man, there's just a way that I could talk to that person, that really pretty one over there, about the truth. You ever have that happen? Like, that's just a natural reaction for me. What about that ugly girl that's right next to you? What about those two guys that are picking their nose on the other side of you? You don't want to share the truth with them? They're not pretty enough? No, ignore them. I got to spend all my time and energy finding a way to get a conversation with that girl over there that doesn't even know I exist about the truth. You know what Christ called that? Respect of persons. Respect of persons. When you say, I'm going to try really hard to teach the truth to that person over there because they're pretty, And I'm not even going to worry about sharing it with the person next to me because they're not that good looking. I've been guilty of that lots of times. It's a natural thing. It's something we need to fight. So let's think about this a little different way. There's another thing I want to add to that. You know, what if I do get that chance to talk to that girl? Do you think I'm going to be very effective at sharing the truth with her if I'm picking my jaw off the floor every time she bats her eyes at me? Probably not that effective, right? It's probably kind of going to get in the way a little bit. What if, what if, say, Alexis was talking to her about the truth? She wouldn't have that problem, would she? No. What if I'm talking to the guy next to me in the class? Am I going to have that same problem talking to him? No. So it makes way more sense for me to be talking to the guy next to me than to be talking to that pretty girl across the room. But if I'm only thinking of myself, I'm only thinking what I want, I'm not going to do that. Okay? But if we put God first, if we put God first, and say there's a young sister here who's in desperate, who has this desperate need for companionship, and there's a potential husband for her that I should be teaching the truth. I have every opportunity to teach him the truth. And yet I'm too interested in filling my own needs to even talk to that guy. Be the guy that brings him to the truth. It may be years down the line before they ever get involved and develop a relationship and have a marriage. But you know, if I'm not thinking about myself, I can make that happen. I can bring somebody in the truth effectively. And I can leave God and others to share the truth with others. And maybe someone that's a potential mate for me will learn the truth from someone else. But that won't happen if we're always thinking, me, me, me. I need a mate for me. I need to preach to someone who's compatible with me. No. Put that on the back burner for a while. Who does God want me to preach to? Who do I get the opportunities to share the truth with? That's where it's really at. That is Christ's attitude. It's not respect of persons. It's Christ's attitude. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about today is circumcision. I think this is the last thing. Yeah, that's the last thing. I've got a short quote read at the end, but circumcision is the last thing I want to talk about. And we're going to talk about why circumcision was used and why it is underscores the importance of appropriate relationships. A circumcision was a really important ritual in the Old Testament believers. We just read about in our first portion that Moses almost got killed. There was an angel waiting for him in the way to kill him because he hadn't circumcised his son, right? That's how important circumcision was. It was important before Moses and after Moses. It was a God-given command to circumcise the flesh of the foreskin. If you don't know what circumcision is, just ask your parents at home. I'm not going to go into detail here. Circumcise the flesh of the foreskin. And it was a fitting symbol of cutting off of the flesh and its desires. Why, though? There's a lot of other ways that we could cut off the flesh without circumcision, right? Why did he choose circumcision? Why was it in the foreskin that it took place? The scriptures tell us that we battle the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, right? Those are the three battlegrounds that the flesh loves to engage us in. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and pride and possessions is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whosoever does the will of God abides forever. These are our three points of stumbling, the three strongholds of temptation. They are three ways that we are ensnared by the flesh. It's got three kinds of traps for us. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Which of these three, someone tell me, which of these three does not find a strong place in the natural sexual attraction between male and female? Are any of them not there? They are all there. The first to act is the lust of the eyes. When we as men see a beautiful woman, that lust is triggered. Or as a woman, you see this handsome man. It's natural. Because it's of the natural man, right? It's of the natural man to be drawn away by what is seen. But the lust of the eyes is not alone for long. It quickly stirs up the lust of the flesh. That's our desire, this wave of desire that comes over us for that object of beauty. The lust of the eyes has a friend now, the lust of the flesh. And they're working together. They're in cooperation. They're feeding off one another. They're strengthening one another. The lust of the flesh, I warn her, makes me take another look. And then the lust of the eyes reinforces that lust of the flesh. Oh yeah, I want her really bad. Okay? In the midst of this challenge, pride of life rears its head. Man, wouldn't it be wonderful to have that girl? Wouldn't it be wonderful to have that guy? Wouldn't it be so grand, so great to have that beautiful woman on my arm, stroking my ego, making me look like more of a man? No other man could compare to me if I had her. Or, as a woman, wouldn't I just sit as a queen with that man? No woman would dare to look down on me or talk about me with a man like that all to myself. And the temptation is complete. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life have combined to form a strong temptation embodying each of the three areas of enticement. The desire is the climax of sin's pull on our mind. Romantic attraction is one area where all of our desires, each type of temptation, is felt very keenly. This is the flesh that we must make no provision for, the fulfillment of its lusts. This is the set of desires that we must cut off, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. At least one of them is responsible for every temptation we meet, but they are all seen, all three of them, in the attraction between a man and a woman. It is no wonder, then, that the cutting off of the foreskin became a symbol of the cutting off of the whole of the flesh, of cutting off all fleshly desires. It is because each of those desires is seen in sexual attraction. Do you think applying God's principles to relationships between an attractive man and attractive woman is a challenge? You think it's challenging to use godly principles when you're head over heels for a woman, or head over heels for a man? Yeah, I do. While we're considering these things, actually, it can be the greatest challenge we face in life. And the reason it can be the greatest challenge is because it's the culmination, it's the joining of all our fleshly desires. It requires the mind of the Spirit to overcome it. And we cannot get the mind of the Spirit if we are not born of the Word, if we are not washing ourselves in the Word every day. That's the only way we're going to overcome those temptations. While we're considering these three things, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, we might do well to ask if they have any value in selecting a marriage partner. Do the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life have any value when we're looking for a marriage partner? Well, the lust of the eyes is the initial attraction. It's the impulse towards someone based only on sight. It has no consideration for the character of a person. It sees only the outside and is based solely on the pleasure that is gotten by looking at a person. It sees only the outside and is based solely on the pleasure that is gotten by looking at a person. Is that a basis for an appropriate marriage? Nope. It may be a nice thing, but it cannot be the foundation. What about the lust of the flesh? Well, the lust of the flesh is the natural craving for intimacy with a person. It again is not based on the character of a person or the needs of the person or the true value of the relationship. It's based on a supposed fulfillment of selfish desires. Does it help us? Does selfishness help us in selecting a mate? Not really. What about the pride of life? The pride of life works directly against the mind of the Spirit. Psalm 51:17 tells us, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise." The increase in pride that comes with having an attractive partner is actually a challenge to the spirit we are to develop, not a help to it. Each of these desires is selfish. They center on pleasing oneself. True love, though, is selfless. It looks for the benefit of others and not of itself. Christ taught us true love. What did Christ do? He laid down his life for his friends. He was not looking to please himself. He was looking to please others. So must the marriage relationship be. It must overcome the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. It must look beyond them to the glory of God. You ever think about the glory of God when you're trying to find someone to date? Not just like what you do in your actions, but how that relationship, how you being with someone will bring more glory to God than you and that person individually. That's what we're talking about here. So the marriage relationship must be. It must overcome the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. It must look to the spiritual benefit of the partner. It must look to the improvement in services to others that can be done as a couple. Does that mean your wife shouldn't be attractive to you? No. Does it mean your husband shouldn't be attractive to you? No. We talked about how God knows our profile of attraction. He knows exactly what we like, what we don't like. He made us that way. He formed our very mind. He knows exactly the qualities that in a person that will make our heart go pitter-patter. But that's not the focus, is it? What we have to focus on, God can provide those things. We don't know how to provide those things. God can provide those things. And what we need to focus on is God. We read in 2 Corinthians 5, "For the love of Christ controls us, because we have concluded this, that one has died for all. Therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised." The Bible teaches that if we truly trust in Jesus Christ, we die to our old way of living. And we can no longer live for ourselves. We now live for God and for the good of others. If there is one aspect of life that is really hard to do in, it's dating. It is really hard to be unselfish about dating. Because of this, relationships with the opposite sex can no longer be about pleasing me. Can no longer be about having a good time. It cannot be about getting, but giving. Responsibility. Responsibility is not always the funnest thing to do. Every relationship for a brother or sister of Christ is an opportunity to love another person like God has loved us. To lay down our desires and do what's in his or her best interest. To care for him or her, even when there's nothing in it for us. To want that person's purity. Get this. When you find someone and you're dating them, true love is to want that person's purity and holiness because it pleases God and protects him or her. That is a proper basis for a relationship, isn't it? We talked in the first class about making sacrifices in a relationship. And we also talked about something that I didn't review. And I want to review it before we close here. If I can find it, if I can remember it. I'm not seeing it, but the question was how, you know, when you, as guys, young guys, when you find that girl that's like really attractive and she's got the perfect face, the perfect body, this beautiful character, this huge heart, okay, and you're just sold on her, how do you show her that you love her? And what are ways that you can show her you really like her? Okay. That was the question. And we put out a few answers, possible answers. You know, one way that we might typically think of doing that is these passionate kisses that you see people give each other, right? Another possibility was a candlelight supper and flowers. You know, this intimacy that we often see between a married couple, a husband and a wife, on their anniversary or something like that. Is that the way that we show someone that we love them in a dating relationship? Or even before you're dating someone? Now, actually, the scriptures say that the commandments of God are fulfilled in love. In other words, if we want to show our love to someone, we have to incorporate God's commands in our dealings with that person. That's what it means. If loving someone else looks like trying to help them become a better servant of God, trying to help them become a better servant of Christ. If you want to give them a lot of attention, you make sure that attention is in a way that manifests God's character. If you can manifest God's character to someone, you are showing love, because God is love. God is love, right? If you can manifest God's character to someone, you are showing them love. And most girls won't respond to that. And most guys won't respond to that. But if you're looking for the right kind, they will. They will. That's what they're craving, and that's what they'll respond to. So I'll close with, this is actually an encouraging word. I think it was Brother Dennis Acabo that sent it in. And I'll just close quickly with it. I found that it applied to this and kind of overarched the whole discussion. Dear brethren and sisters, we can ask for anything, but should couple the request with, "Not my will, but thine be done." Certainly applies to dating relationships. We can ask for anything, but should couple the request with, "Not my will, but thine be done." God knows what we need. We know only what we want. Jesus said, "Your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask Him." If we pray chiefly for what we want, we are likely to be disappointed. But when we pray chiefly on what God wants to give us, perhaps patience, fortitude to bear trouble, we can find relief and peace of mind. Above all, the most necessary prayer for each of us, being human and lacking ready-made perfect characters, is the utterly simple one voiced long ago: "I pray thee, O God, that I may be beautiful within." I pray thee, God, that I may be beautiful within.